was at Speaker's Corner last Sunday. You were all there. You saw what happened. The Muslims stayed away. They did not like what we were introducing. It's the one place we can do that at Speaker's Corner. So tomorrow I'm going to unpack that, and then we're going to go in. We're just going to look much more in depth at the Quran, how to shut down the Quran. Then on Wednesday night, I'll be at Limehouse. And if any of you want to come, both those talks are at 7 o'clock. We do have flyers. It'll give you the place where we're going to be. But do not bring Muslims. This week, today, if Muslims are here, or if there are any Muslims, God bless you. I'm glad you're here. But tomorrow night and Wednesday, we're training up missionaries to the Muslim world. And so we're going to be introducing some stuff I don't want Muslims to have to be aware of. The new material, it'll be tomorrow. But you are all welcome if you love Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, which I hope you all do. And if you don't, bless you, we're going to make sure you do before you leave. So that's tomorrow night. Monday night, we'll be in Leytonstone. Wednesday, we'll be in Limehouse. Tonight, what I'm going to do is what you see up on the screen. And I'm going to do a historical critique looking at the material that has moved on since 2019. If any of you are watching what we're doing on the internet, on YouTube, come up to Fander Films. I'm putting a video up almost every other day because there's so much new material coming down the pike, especially coming out of Germany. God bless them. They are way ahead of the rest of the world, but they're keeping it in German so that we can't understand it. And we finally got to them, and I've got Dr. Robert Kerr, Dr. von Bothmer, Dr. Oleg, Dr. Luxemburg, I'll be introducing him tonight. These are all the top scholars in the world in Germany who have been going leaps and bounds ahead of everybody because they're all linguists. Dr. Robert Kerr, 10 languages that he can speak, read and write, mostly archaic languages. So they're at the forefront of this material, but they keep it in German because they don't want the Muslims to hear about it. Well, I want the Muslims to hear about it. So what I said to them is, I will be a vehicle for you to come on board, unpack it in English, because once it's in English, the whole world has to hear it. So that's going to be, that's the new material that we're now starting to get into. Some of that I will be introducing tonight, but I'm not permitted to introduce what I have not put on Fander Film yet. So that, you'll have to wait till September and October. The juiciest stuff is yet to come. It is so much fun. God bless the Germans. So let's go ahead and let's talk about the historical critique. Now, there are going to be four areas that I'm going to investigate. The first one, I'm going to start with the problem of sources. This should not be new to most of you. The whole problem of sources of what we know and where we're getting it from. And then we're going to go right into the problem of Mecca itself. You know what I'm talking about because you're one of my students in the MAPI program. So it's good to see you again. The whole problem of Mecca. And then we're going to move right into how do we think early Islam began? What are the difficulties basically with the man Muhammad? And then we'll move into the Quran and we'll end with the Quran. So that's an awful lot to bite off in one night. But I'm trying to get it all in one go in an hour and a half. So bear with me. Don't take notes. You're not going to keep up. All of this is being recorded, by the way. So you can get the recording. And you can turn it, like my Korean students, turn it down a third or fourth so I sound beautiful baritone. And you can hear me, and you can see and hear me in slow motion. So you can get your notes later on. Now, the standard Islamic narrative, what am I talking about? It's a play on words, you might say. Standard Islamic narrative, S-I-N, sin, is the traditional view of Islam. This is what the Muslims believe. This is the traditions. This would be the sira of the prophet. This would be the hadith, the sayings. This would be the tafsir, which would be the commentaries. And this would be the tahriq. Anything that Muslims do, how they walk, talk, eat, drink, is the standard Islamic narrative. So when you hear me use this, sin, I'm talking about that. That's what you know. That's what all of you have been taught. Anybody who has studied Islam or has had any course on Islam has only heard the standard Islamic narrative, okay? And that's what I'm going to be confronting tonight. Now, the standard Islamic narrative takes as its premise that Islam has been around for 1,400 years. Am I correct? Yeah. They would say that Muhammad was the last and greatest prophet, born in Mecca in 570, died in 632. And they would say that he is the model for all mankind in the world today. How he walks, talks, eats, drinks is how they are to walk, talk, eat, and drink. He is the one that received the Quran from 610 to 632, that 22-year period. They would say that the Quran is his revelation, was sent down between those years, 610 to 632. It's the final, the greatest. It is the seal of all revelations, and it corrects all previous revelations, specifically the Old and New Testament. Therefore, Islam is the final religion based on Muhammad's life and sayings, that's the Sunnah, and on the Quran's teaching. Now, this you've all heard before. I'm not telling you anything new, right? Conclusion, Islam is therefore completely dependent on one book, one man, and one place. Right? The book is the Quran, the man is Muhammad, the place is Mecca, the book, the man, the place. That's all you need to know, really, to really confront Muslims. Because any one of those, if you take any one of those, you destroy the other two. Since these three areas are foundational Islam, we should investigate them. Stands to reason. Which means we need to go back to the 7th century. Because it's the book, the man, and the place that were in the 7th century that we need to look at. In the place they existed, the central part of Arabia, the Hijaz, as known as where Mecca and Medina are. That's the Hijaz. All right? And let's start then with the sources. Sources, what I mean by sources is where you have got everything that you know about Islam. Where did you get it from? Where did it come? Where did it all come from? Well, let's look at that map. According to the standard Islamic narrative, you have Muhammad's empire, that brown area. So that was the area that he controlled by 632. Islam was in that brown area. So basically, it's the central part of Arabia down to Yemen. That brown area, right there. Then after him comes the Rashidun period, that is Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali. Those are the four rightly guided caliphs that come after Muhammad. So that's that orange area, from all the way from Afghanistan to Tripoli in Libya, that whole area today. So it expanded its borders hugely during the time of Umar and Uthman, all right? So I'm going to be talking about that era, and then we're going to end with the Umayyad dynasty, which is the first Islamic empire, from 661 up until 749 or 750. Basically the mid 7th century to the mid 8th century. Memorize that map, get it in your mind, because that's the area we're going to talk about. That's according to their narrative. Now, to do that, we need to start with a timeline. So let's start with this timeline. Muhammad was born in 570. This is the standard Islamic narrative. I'm not saying anything you haven't heard before. He started receiving the Quran in 610. There's the timeline there. He was woken up in the middle of the night, told to get on the back of a winged horse called the Burak, and he flew from Mecca up to Jerusalem. There, where the Dome of the Rock is today, he then ascended seven heavens. That's called the Mi'raj, and he received 50 prayers, which he came down to the fifth heaven, saw Moses. He said, no, that's way too many. So he bounced back and forth between the seventh and the fifth heaven and got the prayers from 50 down to 45, down to 15, 10, finally five prayers. That's why Muslims pray five times a day, because of what happened in 621. If there's anybody that wants to question me, feels free so, because so far I'm saying everything that's the standard Islamic narrative. So if there's any Muslims here and you want to say I've said something wrong, please do. I would love to see if I'm doing something wrong here. That's 621, right? And then in 622, he then moves from Mecca to Medina with about maybe 80, 120. It depends on which tradition you're going to look at. They follow him. They're called the Muhajirun. And he goes and arbitrates between the Jews and the Ansar there in Medina. So he's a guest in Medina. And then in 630, he then conquers Mecca. 2 years later, he then dies. And that's his life. I'm just giving you the bare skeleton. So that's the beginning of Islam right there with Muhammad. Primarily from 610 up until 632. After him comes Abu Bakr. He only lasts 2 years. Then he dies peacefully. Then you have Umar, who lasts 10 years from 634 to 644. He is killed. Then comes Uthman. He lasts 12 years. He is killed. But while he is there, the Quran is compiled. So that is when the Quran was put together during his reign. So roughly 20 years after Muhammad. And that's this book that I have in my hand here. This is the Quran from Uthman. Not from Muhammad, from Uthman. You'll see why I'm saying that. After him comes Ali, because Uthman is killed. Ali takes over, and he only lasts 5 years. He's killed at the Battle of Siffin there in 661. Then comes the Umayyad dynasty with Muawiyah, the first caliph. All right, are you following me so far? This is very easy stuff. This is Islam 101 so far. Islam was completely formed, therefore, according to the Islamic traditions, by 661, including Muhammad's life, his ministry, and the four rightly guided caliphs, the Rashidun period, the golden era of Islam. And that's the prayer era that they want to take all of us back to. That's the golden period. They would like us all to return back to that era. Now, how do we know all of this above? How do I know everything I've just told you in the last 10 minutes? Where do we get that from? Where would you like it to have come from? Not the Quran. Yo, this man knows his material. But who would you like the person to have written this all down? An eyewitness, right? You would hope that this would be written by an eyewitness, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We're going to get to that. But let's look at another timeline, because everything you have been taught so far about Islam, you have thought comes from eyewitnesses. And 99.9% of every Muslim you talk to suggests that they were all written by people who were companions of the Prophet, who knew Muhammad, right? Take a look at this timeline. Now we're getting into the source. So, Muhammad dies in 632. But where do we get that story from? Now, this gentleman back here already knows the answer, Ibn Ishaq, right? And you're sure it's Ibn Ishaq? Okay, don't go on. I want to ask you, is that Ibn Ishaq? Yeah. Are you sure? Can you show me something from Ibn Ishaq? No, you can't. Hold on, he's jumping ahead already. He cannot show me anything from Ibn Ishaq. Johannes, you're going to be my Muslim tonight, okay? Abdul, come up here and sit here. I want to talk to you. Johannes is a good friend of mine. He just got his doctorate. Give him a hand. Dr. Bekele from Yah. Now, we have worked many years together. No, talk to me. Don't talk to her. You talk to me. We have worked many years together, haven't we? And Abdul, you're going to be Abdul tonight. So far, everything we get is from Ibn Ishaq, right?
That's right.
Okay, and you trust Ibn Ishaq?
Alhamdulillah.
Can you show me anything from Ibn Ishaq? No, don't. You're a Muslim tonight, all right? So act like a Muslim, think like a Muslim. You know I'm going to, it's a trick question, I know, so you're feeling a little uneasy right now. But every Muslim will say, yes, Ibn Ishaq is where we get it from. When did Ibn Ishaq die?
65.
How many years is that after Muhammad? Roughly 130. Just say yes to everything I say. Roughly 130 years. Is that a problem for any of you?
Yes.
Even for you, the gentleman back there, it's a problem for you, right? Please say yes. That's obviously, this is not an eyewitness to Muhammad, right? He's not even from the same century. But we have nothing from Ibn Ishaq, not a word, not one sentence. We have to go to this guy, Ibn Hisham, who you were about ready to say, right? He dies in 833, right? That's 200 years, right? Does that bother any of you?
Yes.
It bothers me. I'm going to get rid of Ibn Ishaq. We don't need him anymore, because really, there's nothing from him. So we go to Ibn Hisham, right? But I want to ask anybody here, can you show me anything written by Ibn Hisham? You're going to show me the Sira to La Surah, written by Alfred Guillaume, which is a translation in French from a German Sira.
Yes, yes.
But you have no idea who wrote that Sira. Wüstenfeld, a German scholar in 1860.
Wow.
Let me repeat that. This is the first time you've ever heard this. The biography of Muhammad, everything we know about Muhammad, comes from a German scholar in 1860 who went to different German cities, went to different German museums and libraries, and took what he could of scraps of pieces of material written during the Ottoman period, nothing before 1300 AD, put it together into the Sira we have today. That is the Sira that you're reading, written in 1860. And you've never heard that until today. Have any of you heard this before? The Germans have been holding this secret all this time. We're going to expose it in September. Wait till the Muslims hear this. Everything they've known about their prophet comes from 1860. Ooh, I love it. Makes my job so easy. Now let's get back to this, because certainly Ibn Hisham is the one we think is the one that wrote it down. We have no manuscript from his time, 833. There's no manuscript of anybody from Ibn Hisham's time. We also have Al-Waqidi, and Al-Waqidi is the one that wrote about the battles, the 29 battles that Muhammad was involved in, and that is from 835. We don't have any documents whatsoever from 835. It's all attributions. These are attributed to these individuals. There's no originals of any of them. Well, we do have the hadith, and so we need to get to the hadith because these are much more prolific, and they're the ones that Muslims use to know how to walk, talk, eat, and drink. Every law, everything that they do that Muhammad did, they find in the hadith. So you go to, let's start with Al-Bukhari. Al-Bukhari is the one that writes down about how the Quran is put together. He is the most authoritative. He's called Sahih. That means there is no error. And after Sahih, after him, you have Sahih Muslim, you have Ibn Dawud, Ibn Tirmidhi, you have an Ibn Majah, and you have, I said Ibn Dawud already, and you have An-Nasa'i. Those are the six authoritative hadith that are put into Ibn Masabi. That is the six authoritative ones that all Muslims use today. But take a look at their dates. Do you see? They come even after Ibn Hisham. That's 240 years later. And then, we've got the tafsir and the tahqiq. Those are the other two genres. Those are the commentaries that help us to know how the Quran is to be read, and there's also the history of mankind. They're what we know as the tahqiq. Those were first introduced by a man named Al-Tabari in the 923. That is the 10th century. Which means everything we know about Islam, about Muhammad, about Mecca, about the Quran, everything we know about how Islam began came from 200 years after the fact, at the beginning. That's what everyone is told, and that's what you've all believed until you heard what I just told you about Wüstenfeld. Can you see then? We're sitting on a bombshell here. But I want to bring up this guy here, because it is Abdul Malik who is the one that introduces the name Muhammad to us. Before him, we don't really know about this man named Muhammad. He introduces it on the Dome of the Rock in 691, on the coins in 692, and on the caliphal protocols in the same year. Muhammad had died in 632, according to the Islamic tradition, right? Mm-hmm. Yet everything we know about this man is first introduced by this man. What you're going to find, this man, when he introduced the name, had nothing to do with Muhammad the man. Hold on a minute. Then I want to get to the Abbasids, because the Abbasids are the one that create the Muhammad we have today. And they only come to power in 749, mid-8th century. Everything that Muslims will tell you comes from after 750. Muhammad died in 632. You can see there's a problem there already. I just want to show you on a map what we're talking about. So according to the standard Islamic narrative, everything happens in those two cities there, right? Mecca and Medina, where they're the little green circles. But it's all written down in Baghdad. Why weren't they written in Mecca and Medina? For one very good reason. There was no Mecca, but we're going to get to that. Ibn Hisham, that you like back there, he was born in Basra, but he grew up in Cairo. Those are 990 to 1,200 miles away from Mecca, not anywhere near Mecca. As far as the Al-Bukhari and the Hadith, well, look where he comes from. He comes from Bukhara, which is Tajikistan today. And, of course, that's over 2,600 miles away. If you want to talk about Al-Tabari, well, he comes from Tabaristan, which is in northern Iran today. That is a good 1,700 miles away, nowhere near Mecca or Medina. So all these references, everything we know about Muhammad, how about the Quran, about how Islam began, comes from hundreds of miles away. And what's more, none of the traditional writers lived or worked in Mecca or Medina. They were too far to the north of Mecca and came from the west and east of Baghdad. All of these northern areas are where the Abbasids originated from. To make that point a little bit more, let's just look at a map again and let's just repeat it. So the problem of the northern hegemony, the Islamic traditions say everything happened in Mecca and Medina. That's what they've been telling us. That's what you've heard, right? Yet when you look at all the writers and everything that Islam is dependent on, look and see on the map where they're coming from. None of them are written down south. None, or what I should say, the central part of Arabia. They're all in the Fertile Crescent. They're where the water is. They're where the vegetation is. They're where the people are. They're where the civilization is. All right? Take that. You'll see why that's important.
Because the interesting thing about that map is that how does it make the number actually speak about the same person? Because if you have a happy in one region and you have a happy in another region, there's no way to assume that that's the same person that they're actually talking about. Because some of them are written like 200 years after.
Okay, but let me just take one step further. That's a good point. What does Muhammad mean? It is actually the praised one. So it's not even name, is it?
Yeah.
Which means anybody can be called the praised one. Muawiyah used the word Muhammad to refer to himself. Abdul Malik used the word Muhammad to refer to himself. Abdul Malik on the Dome of the Rock, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, which is the Shahada, is all referring to Jesus Christ. On the Dome of the Rock, on the coins, the Shahada that is introduced there in 691 all refer to Jesus. Hold on, we're going to get to that. It gets better and better as we go on tonight. You'll see why this is so easy to use. Now, all of the northern areas are where the Abbasids originated from. Furthermore, all of the writers, the traditions worked in the 9th and 10th century, they all wrote the material hundreds of miles too far away and hundreds of years too late. Look at the timeline and look at the map and put them together. That Muslims don't know what to do with. And for most Muslims, when I introduce it, it's the first time they've ever heard it because they've never looked at their own history and they've never bothered to look at a map and they've never put it on a timeline. I'm giving you these timelines. You can use this PowerPoint. We'll give it. You've got it on your computer here. You can have this PowerPoint. Use it for heaven's sakes because Muslims need to see this visually. Now you say, okay, we've got the same problem with Christianity, right? We don't have anybody that was there that was actually an eyewitness to what Jesus said and did. Because listen, we've also got the hadith of Jesus. That would be Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We've got the sirah of Jesus. That's his biography, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We got the tafsir, which would be good, Paul's letters with the commentaries. We've also got the tahriq, which would be the book of Acts, the history of the early church. So we've got the same genre in the New Testament that the Muslims are dependent on for their man and their place and their book. We have the same, right? There is the parallels. So let's ask the same question of whether or not we've got this problem, all right? Now, I'm going to step on some toes tonight. You're not going to like my dates. I'm taking the most liberal dates. And let me repeat that because I've been in churches where I've got hammered for this, saying you're a heretic for putting those late dates. I'm doing this purposely. These are not the dates I accept. I'm giving the most liberal dates tonight. So, Tony, you're not to get upset, okay? All right. Even when we use the most liberal dates, take a look at what we have. So Jesus dies in 33 AD. We have the Tahriq, which is the book of Acts, which is the first part that's written down, written by the book of Acts written by Luke. Between 52 and 62 AD, that's within 20 to 30 years of Christ's death, right? And then you have Paul's letters, which would be the tafsir of Jesus. That's the commentaries of Jesus, what Jesus said and did. And he starts within 15 years to 34 years after Christ died. He died in 65 AD, so therefore it stopped with his death. All right? And then we have the first of what we call the sirah and the hadith, written by Mark in 70 AD. I know the dates are wrong, but just bear with me, all right? That's about 37 years after Christ. And then you have Matthew and Luke, who are another sitta, another hadith, within by 80 AD, that's 47 years after Christ's death. And then we have the last sitta in the hadith, and that with the Gospel of John, with 90 AD, so about 57 years after Christ's death. Even with the most liberal dates, everything we know about what Jesus said, what he did, about his commentaries, and about the history of the early church were written by within 60 years of Christ's death. And what's more, all of the New Testament writers lived in the same place Jesus lived. They didn't live 100 miles away. And they either knew him personally, like John and Matthew knew him personally, or they got the material from others who saw what he did and heard what he said. Luke and Mark got it from the others who were his eyewitnesses. Can you see what we're talking about? We don't have this problem. Islam has this problem. Thank God. I don't have this problem, or you don't have this. Comparing Christianity with Islam, that means Christianity gets all its material about who Jesus was, what he said and did, within 50 to 60 years of his death. Islam has to wait 200 to 300 years. We're now finding it actually is 7 to 1,000 years. But that's yet to come in September, so I'm just giving you kind of a precursor. Which would you guess is more authoritative? I would suggest the eyewitness account is a lot more authoritative. As a comparison, if we were to depend on sources for our Jesus, comparable to what Muslims have dependent for their Muhammad, we would know nothing about Jesus until the 3rd century. How would we defend him historically? Thank God we follow Jesus. And thank God he has a history. For those of you who are American, this is for the Americans. Let me just show you, for those of us, there's only about 5 of us here, so bear with us. I do this in America and they love it. George Washington, let's take George Washington. He's the father of our country, just like Muhammad is the father of Islam, right? He dies, we have the Constitution made in 1776, and he dies in 1799. If we were dependent on knowing who George Washington was with what Muslims have for Islam, that means his biography would not have appeared until 2000. That's just 22 years ago. His sayings would not have appeared until 2037. We wouldn't even know a word he said yet for another, 17 years. And as far as our Constitution, we would not even know about our Constitution in 2090. How do we even know what we're to do as Americans? Can you see, when you put it in perspective what we're talking today, why haven't Muslims answered to this? Because none of us have held them publicly responsible for this. We've got to go public with this, folks. Washington's biography would have been written and published just 20 years ago, while his speeches in the U.S. Constitution will not have been written for another 15 to 600 years. I would not know what to base our laws on or how the USA began. And when you put it in perspective. And that's why the 21st century scholars are saying what they're saying. According to Humphreys, he says, Islam as we know it did not exist in the 7th century, but evolved over a period of 200 to 300 years. Dr. Rippon, Dr. Lester and Dr. Wandsboro said the Quran probably was not revealed to one man in 22 years, but likely evolved over a period of 50 to 100 years. Cook and Robson say the history of Islam, in their conclusion, at least from the time of the Caliph Abdul Malik, that's 691 and later, and therefore and before, is a later fabrication. Now, I've got to prove that tonight, so let's see what I'm going to do. Well, here's their concern. Why did it take so long to write it down? Why did it take 200 years to write this man's biography down? Were these people not literate? That's what Muslims respond. They're not literate. Hold on a minute. They controlled all the way from Afghanistan in the east to Tripoli in the west. There were city after city they controlled. You're telling me nobody could read and write in all those cities? There was a library in Alexandria that was burned down in the 5th century. You cannot tell me they did not know how to read and write. So where did all these 9th and 10th century scholars or compilers get their material from? Way up north, 200 to 300 years later. Since we don't want to trust the 9th and 10th century, shouldn't we go back to the 7th century? Isn't that the logical place to go as historians? So let's do that tonight. And to do that, we need to just remind you of the map again. Muhammad's empire, according to the standard Islamic narrative, was in the brown area. During the Rashidun period, the next four caliphs was in that orange area. And then the Umayyad dynasty, the first Islamic dynasty, is in the purple area. So we're going to just remind you that. And what we're going to do is we're going to start with Mecca. Why am I starting with Mecca? Because once you shut down Mecca, you shut down Islam. If Mecca did not exist, if we can prove that there was no Mecca, there's no Muhammad or any Quran. It's as simple as that. So that's why I start with Mecca. And it's the easiest to start with. So let's get right into it. Mecca is where everything is in Islam happened. Therefore, the book and the man are absolutely dependent on Mecca. If it did not exist, then neither did the other two. Once you get rid of Mecca in the 7th century, and you get rid of Muhammad, and you get rid of the Quran in the 7th century, at least the Muhammad in the Quran of Islam. There may have been many more Muhammads, as you suggested, but not the man we're looking for, all right? So let's go back and let's look at their claims. Now, they believe that Mecca is the oldest city in history. It's where Adam and Eve lived. You don't get any earlier than Adam and Eve, folks. They're the first. If Adam and Eve were in Mecca, according to chapter 7, verse 24, when they were thrown out of the Garden of Eden, which is in space, they were thrown down to Mecca. Well, actually, Eve was thrown down to Mecca. Adam, God was not a very good aim, and he threw him down to Sri Lanka. Why he could not get him to eat, I don't know. Nonetheless, Adam was 90 feet tall, and he just strode off, boom, 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 and walked up to Mecca to join his wife. Fortunately, she was not that tall. This is the standard Islamic narrative. This is how the story they give. Now, that means Mecca has to be the oldest city in history. Right? You don't have cities without people. There's no one older than Adam and Eve. So it's the oldest city in history. It's also where Abraham lived, according to chapter 21, verse 51 to 71. He lived right there in the Kaaba. So Abraham didn't live up in Israel like you all think. He lived way down in Mecca. He rebuilt the Kaaba. And it's also the center of trade, north, south, east, or west. So therefore, it's a pretty important city. Am I correct? Someone, somewhere, should have heard about it. Now, if you look at the Quran, there's lots of references not to Mecca. Hold on. You will find the reference to the word Mecca only once in the entire Quran. That's in chapter 48, verse 24. That's it. There's lots of reference to the place of the prophet, the city of the prophet, where the prophet lived. But you don't even know the name of the prophet. Because Muhammad's name is only four times in the entire Quran. Doesn't that tell you there's a problem here? If the whole Quran is about him, if all of history is about him, if he is the center of everything Muslims believe and follow and are adhered to, then why is his name only found four times and three of them refer to Jesus Christ? Ooh, I love that. As we're now finding. So here's what's interesting. If Jesus, Isa's name is found almost 93 times, Abraham, Mary, all of them are found many more times than Muhammad, does that not suggest that Muhammad's not very significant to the Quran? Or is this someone else that they're talking about? Nonetheless, if you go to the Quran today, whenever you read it in the translation in English, it's not in the Arabic, they have to put it in parentheses, Mecca, 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 Mecca. And according to those parentheses, it's the first sanctuary of all mankind in chapter 3096. So it's the earliest city in history. It's the mother of all settlements, according to chapter 42, verse 7. It's where Adam and Eve were, as I said earlier, were sent, thrown down to in chapter 724. It's where Abraham lived in chapter 21. It's where Muhammad was born, according to the traditions. It's also where the Qiblas are all faced after 624, after the Miraj in Surah 2, ayah 149 to 150. So that implies people lived there from the very beginning, if it's a city. Yet the only reference, as I said earlier, is only in one verse, chapter 48, verse 24, which says nothing of any mention or worth about it. According to traditions, we hear an awful lot more. Now, the traditions are much, much later than the Quran. So by the time the traditions are put together, there's lots of references to Mecca. We find that it's a place of the Prophet. It's in a valley. It has a parallel valley. It has streams going through it. It's outside of it, or the pillar of salt where Lot's wife was turned to salt. It has fields, trees, grass, fruit, clay, loam, olive trees. How many people have seen pictures of Mecca? Does that sound like Mecca to you? Is there any reference of any of this stuff in Mecca, either today or before? Absolutely not. So it's certainly not the city we're looking at. It's not in a valley. It has none of these listed above because it's in a desert. So it's just too arid and dry to support any of the above, which shows you that there's a problem with these traditions, obviously. When you look at the geography, what's fascinating, if you look at the references, there are 65 geographical references referring to the place of the Prophet. It doesn't say the word Mecca, it just says the place of the Prophet. Nine of the places are named by people who are actually in that place. When you look at those places, you will find that 23 times it refers to the people of Ad. Ad would be the people of Uz in the Bible. Thamud, 24 times it refers to these people of Thamud, who are the Nabataeans in the Bible. Midian, 7 times it talks about the Midianites. But take a look at where they are. They're way up here. Here's Mecca way down here. That's 600 miles between the two. All the references to these people that this prophet is having relationship with, he's seeing them day after day after day. He had to go 600 miles up and 600 miles down. Folks, you have to have a helicopter to do that. There's no way in the world somebody could be living that far south and have that kind of relationship with that many times with those people. Can you see there's a problem? Obviously, where the Quran was written was not that far south. It was much, much further north. Now, when we look at the Arabic in the Quran, and when you look at the Arabic, you will see it has the definite article, it has the tar marbuta, it has the alif maksura. These are articles that are found in the Quran, but are not from that part of the world. All of these definite articles, the tar marbuta and the alif maksura, and I'm not going to get into that unless you know Arabic. For those who know Arabic, you know what I'm talking about. These are unique to the Quran, but if you look at the Arabic that is from Mecca and Medina, which is the green area here, there is no tar marbuta, there is no alif maksura, there is none of these, what we call irabs, these endings, that are found in the Arabic from that area. Why? Because the Arabic from that area is Sabaic Arabic. Sabaic Arabic is from the Sabaeans, which is in Yemen, in Oman today, in the south. They don't have these articles, but the Quran is full of them. The Quran is from this area way up here. The Arabic is Nabataean Aramaic, 600 miles further north. Am I starting to sound like a broken record? You're going to hear me say farther north, all night tonight, for a very good reason. So we're exposing that there's a problem after problem. The Quranic Arabic, Nabataean Aramaic, existed 600 miles further north, while the 7th century Arabic of Mecca, if there was a Quran written in Mecca, would have used the Sabaic Arabic. And here's what's really exciting. It would have accommodated the text of the Quran that we have today, but also it would eradicate the problem with the Qira'at and the Ahruf. Any of you know what I've just said? Any of you? The Qira'at argument. The Ahruf argument. Oh boy, you've got a lot to learn. This is going to be fun. Because this is what's destroying the Quran today. And it was all found by a 5'2" girl who's a lady who's right here in London. Her name is Hatun Tash. Wait till we hear it. I was with her on the ladder last week. She has destroyed the Quran, and we're going to get to that later on. But that is proof that there is a problem with the Quran. Because the Qira'at and the Ahraf, all these dots that you see in the Arabic, and the vowels, the three vowels and the five dots, did not exist in the 7th century. Not in Nabataean Aramaic. Which means the Quran that we have today, when you look at it, had to have been created, had to have evolved. Hold on to that. We'll get to that after the break. What's interesting is all the prophets that have been buried in the in Mecca. Over and over. Take a look at all these prophets. This is new to you, isn't it? Did you know that Adam and Eve were buried there? Well, if they lived there, it makes sense they were buried there. Seth was buried there. Ishmael was buried there. Noah was buried there. Hud, the great-grandfather, son of Noah, was buried there. Sully, the grandfather of Hagar, was buried there. The Queen of Sheba was buried there. Daniel was buried there. Your Daniel was buried in Mecca. So over almost up to 300 prophets were buried in Mecca. They were all buried kneeling, praying, and without any deterioration, so they could continue to pray even in their death. What does that tell you, folks? Well, if you just dug up a little bit, you'll probably find them if they haven't deteriorated. Hold on to that. We'll see. Let's go on. So where is the first reference we have to Mecca? Dr. Patricia Corona, who did a study, did a whole book on Meccan trade and the rise of Islam in 1987, reads and writes 15 languages, was head of department at Cambridge University when she did her study on Mecca. She scoured all the texts to find out any reference to Mecca. If it's where Adam and Eve were, it's where Abraham was, there should be reference after reference to this place. The first reference she found was the Apocalypse of Pseudo-Methodius Continuato Byzantia Arabica, which is written in 741. Muhammad, according to traditions, died in 632. This is over 100 years later. It took them 100 years to finally write the name down. It's not on any map until 900 AD. That's the 10th century. Take a look at the maps, the earliest maps. These are Ptolemy's maps in the 2nd century when he was talking about the Arabian Peninsula. And these are not his maps because he never drew any maps. These are the Europeans who drew them much, much later. This is Leonard Holy's map in 1482. Notice what's missing. Look where the question mark is. That's Mecca. It's not on that map. Here's another one that taken from Ptolemy's references, put together by Laurent Fries in 1541. Even as late as 1541, where's Mecca? It's missing. It should be where that question mark is. Here's another map. This one is put by Sebastian Munzer, taken from Ptolemy's writings. Notice where the question mark is? Mecca is missing. In map after map after map, there is no Mecca. How could there be no Mecca if it's the oldest city in history? If it's the center of all the trade, north, south, east, and west? Why is it they still couldn't find Mecca? We're talking about the 15th century, and this never was a problem for them. This is a redacted map looking back at that time period. Again, Mecca is missing. Even when they redacted back, it's missing. Here's another redacted map. And she noticed this. She said, there's a problem here, folks. You've got to have Mecca on these maps. Otherwise, how can it be such a famous city? How can it have such a great history? Dan Gibson did 25 years of looking at all the mosques, the earliest mosques all over the world. He went physically to over 100 mosques from the 7th, the 8th, and 9th century. He was the only one in the world to do this. And he wanted to find the Qibla. The Qibla is the direction of prayer. Every mosque, when you go into a mosque, it has a Qibla wall facing Mecca today. He went to all the mosques, over every mosque that existed in the 7th up until 706, so up until the 8th century. Not one of them was facing Mecca. They were all facing Petra. Petra. In Jordan, 600 miles further north. Are we starting to see a theme here? Are you starting to see a pattern here? Now we get to the trade route theory. And this has been a problem for the Muslims. They don't know what to do because they can't find Mecca, any reference to it. So Dr. Montgomery Watt in the last century helped them out. He was a scholar. He wanted to find out why is it that we can't find any reference to Mecca? Or where did it get its importance from? And he says, well, the problem was this. All the trade coming from China and from India came across this way. So it went across the Arabian Sea, up through the Persian Gulf, and then it split and went across over what is today Iraq, and what is today Syria, over to the Mediterranean. That's where the arrows are. And the trade was fine until the Sassanians had a problem with the Byzantines. The Sassanians were Persian, they were Zoroastrian, the Byzantines were Christian, Greek speaking. They started warring with each other in the 5th and 6th and 7th century, so that shut down that trade. So let's get rid of the trade route. They could no longer go that route anymore. So Dr. Montgomery Watt said, okay, the trade was redirected across the Arabian Sea down to Aden, and then went zip, 1,250 miles right up that red line up to Gaza in the north. Problem solved. And everybody everywhere now believes this. Take a look at the map. Do any of you have a problem with that? Just look at the map and you see a problem. My 10-year-old son saw this. Let's see if any of you can see it. What's wrong with that theory? What's that? Ooh, he got it. Have you heard me say this before? Is this the first time you've seen it? You're a good man. Did you all hear him? There's a seaway there. There's water there. Why didn't they go up the waterway? My 10-year-old son found that. And Dr. Patricia Grun said, well, hold on a minute. But before we get into that, let's go through another thing she saw. She says, hold on a minute. If you're going up the western plateau of Arabia, 1,250 miles, and you start at Aden there, and you go up to Taif, then from Taif, you've got to come back down to Mecca. Can you see the detour there?
Yeah.
Down 3,000 feet, 1,000 meters. Down to a place that has no water. We're going to get to that. And then from there, you got to go back up 3,000 feet to get to Yathrib, and then from Yathrib on up to Khaybar, Tabuk, and then on up to Gaza. Well, actually, Petra, then Gaza. She said, look at the detour. Can you see it on the map? Why hadn't anybody looked at this before? So that was the first problem. But then she says, hold on a minute. If you take a ton of good by land and you just go 50 miles, it's the same price for going 1,250 miles by sea, including today. That's why all our big carriers, they bring all the stuff from China here. Why do they bring it by sea? Because it's the cheapest way to go, especially when all you had, what you needed was wind and sails. So why in the world would they take all those goods over to Aden and then travel 1,250 miles? You have to protect it. You have to feed the camels. You've got to find water. In a desert, there is no water. How did they do it? Well, they didn't, because she speaks 15 languages. She went back to all the trading documents from the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, right up into the 8th century, and guess what she found? All of the trade was maritime. It followed the green arrows. Look at the green arrows. They may have stopped in Aden. She doesn't doubt that they stopped in Aden to get some goods, but they did not take anything off there. They just went up to Agilis, which is in Eritrea today. And from Agilis, they went right up the Red Sea, right up to Petra, and from Petra right on over to Gaza, and right all over the Mediterranean world. This is so well documented. Why had no one noticed this before, she said. Well, then what do you do with Mecca? That just wiped out good old Montgomery Watt. But hold on, she didn't go far enough. We've just learned something new concerning the Red Sea trade route. It gets even better. This is what she didn't know. And on my Fander films, a guy sent me this map. He said, Jade, take a look at this map. This is a topographical map looking down from space onto the Red Sea. He said, look at the channel that's there. See the channel there? I'm just putting red for you. That's where the large ships today go. You need a deep channel. They went all right up that. But back then, they didn't have large ships. They had small ships that were pushed by wind. If you want to look and see where their channels are, there's the channels for the small ships. Notice what side of the sea, Red Sea, are they on? They're on the African side. They're not on the Arab side. So none of it went up to Jeddah. None of it went up to Yanbu. It went on the African side. And why did it go on the African side? Well, unlike the East Arabian shore, which was arid with no fresh water and thus few people, the West African shore had plenty of fresh water and had larger populations. What's more, the West Coast has easily accessible ports. We know their names. This is what our team found out. No one had done this before. And we said, let's look and see what we know about the trade from that time period. There are five trading routes, and take a look what they are. You have Assab, which is in Eritrea. You have Agilis, which is in Eritrea, close to where you grew, where you're from. We have also Suakin in Sudan. And then you also have Berenice. And then you have Safaga in Egypt. Those are the two Egyptian. Take a look at where they're all. They're all on the African coast. Look at the dates. 282 BC, 275 BC, 170 AD, these all predate Islam. They're all before Mecca, they're all before Jeddah. And take a look at on the map. How far are they from each other? They're exactly one boat's ride. So from every night they could pull into the boat to the port and get refreshed. Why? Because they need water, folks. You need water. I can't get it. Stress is enough. All five are a day's distance. On the Red Sea, Eastern Arabian coast, only Yanbu is known as Yathrib's port city. That's the only one that has any history. Well, what about Jeddah and Mecca? Jeddah is there today. And Dr. I can't remember his name right now, did a whole work on just Jeddah. And he looked at Jeddah and he said, hold on a minute. Jeddah did not exist before the 8th century. Jeddah was created to give produce to Mecca. Until Mecca was chosen, there was no need for Jeddah because Mecca had no water. They needed water. They needed provisions. That's why Jeddah was created. It was created in the 8th century, folks. Therefore, let's get rid of Jeddah and Mecca. And the reason why? There's just no water there. But if you don't have Mecca, you don't have Jeddah, what happens to Islam? A big red X. Gets better than that. Let's just look at a topographical map to show you why Mecca did not exist. Let's look at this map here, looking at from the Quran. Remind ourselves where exactly Mecca is in relation to the other known cities of Arabia. These cities are all well known because this is where the trade went. This is the local trade. Started at Aden, went to Sana, went up to Najran, went from Taif up to Yathrib. Can you see what they're on? This is called the Western Plateau. Can you see the Western Plateau there? And from there, went up to Tabuk, and then up to Petra, and then to Gaza. That is well known. Every one of those cities are well documented, but they are just nothing more than hamlets. There is no Kaaba, there's nothing. So where's Mecca? Bingo. See where Mecca is? Do you see a problem? Let me emphasize even better. Let's look at a topographical map using lines. Let's do it again. Aden's here, there's Sana, then Najran, there's Taif, there's Yathrib, up there's Tabuk, up to Petra, and then Gaza. So where's Mecca? It's completely off the Western Plateau. And no one noticed this until Dr. Patricia Corona noticed it and wrote a book about it in 1987, published the book and got death threats from Muslims for what she had written. Can you see why no one wants to talk about this? You get death threats for even noticing this. That's why, folks, we've got to make this public. Mecca could not even exist, even if it was a trade city. It's off the trade route. It's too far off the plateau. What? Let's look and see whether or not the civilizations knew about this place. Let's ask a perfectly good question. If Mecca was known, then someone somewhere should have known about it. It's the oldest city in the history of mankind. Certainly, someone should have known about it. So, what about the empires which were in that area? Let's just look and ask that, okay? Saba, look at all the documentation. Dr. Patricia Crone looked at this. Not one word about Mecca. What about Himyar? Not one word about Mecca. What about the Eastern Arabia? Not one word about Mecca. What about Western Arabia where Mecca is situated? Not one word about Mecca. How about the patriarchal period and what we know from our own biblical records? Not one word about Mecca. How about the Himyarites? Again, the Assyrians didn't know about it. Neither did the Babylonians. The central Western Arabia didn't know about it. The Persians and certainly the Romans. Not one word. I pretty well completely surrounded Mecca. No civilization that was close by had ever heard of Mecca. Not one word. We can't find any documentation. And if Muslims are listening to me, if you can want to prove Mecca, you're going to have to show me some documentation from some civilization, from some map, from somebody about this place before the 7th century. Now, just take a look at these four maps. These are topographical maps. What do you notice? Where Mecca and Medina are, do you see where they are on the maps? It's a desert. I did this, I don't know if you were there, Johannes, or you were there, I think, in November when I came. I did this from the ladder. I did then the ladder, and this is what you can do. If Mecca and Medina are in the desert, central part of Arabia, where there's a desert, there's no water. Where there's no water, there's no food. Where there's no food, there's no people. Where there's no people, there's no towns. Where there's no towns, there's no cities. Where there's no cities, there's no civilization. If there's no civilization, there is no history. There is no history. That's all I had to say at one time. How long did it take me to say that? Every time a Muslim comes up to me and says, well, wait a minute, what about Muhammad? Wait a minute, there's no water there. Okay, well, what about the... Wait, there's no water. All I had to say is one word, water. Water. And it shut down the argument. Once they realize that you cannot have a civilization unless you have water, that's why all of the history is in the north. That's where the water is. It's as simple as that, folks. Do you see how easy it gets? And you can do the same thing. Just like Mars, without water, there's no point in even going there. So what about the Hajj? What about the Hajj? Let's look at the Hajj. Because the Hajj is where every Muslim goes to. Now, when you look at the Hajj, you will see the Kaaba there. But here is the interesting thing. The Kaaba is the Arabic word for Kaaba in Hebrew, which means cube. Where do you think the first cube was? Well, it was in Petra. But the original cube is on top of Mount Moriah in Jerusalem, the Holy of the Holies. What do they do in Mecca? They go 7 times, which direction? Counterclockwise. Who did 7 times counterclockwise, and why the number 7? Anybody know? The Jews did it because of Jericho, going 7 times counterclockwise. This is straight out of Jerusalem. It's been borrowed from Jerusalem. Even the word, the Kaaba, and the circumambulation 7 times is exactly what they did in Jerusalem. Let's take a look at Marwa and Safa. After they do 7 times around the Kaaba, every Muslim knows that they are to run back and forth between 2 mountains called Marwa and Safa. They're about 100 yards apart. They're only 100 yards from the Kaaba. Does anybody know why they run back and forth 7 times? Again, why the number 7? Because that's the perfect number in Judaism. Ask any Muslim that, they have no idea. Come on home. There's a reason why. If you just ask the Jews, they'll tell you. But Marwa and Safa, 7 times. Because that's where Hagar was looking for water. She was looking for water for Ishmael. So she runs to this mountain, no water. So she runs to this mountain, Safa, no water. She runs back and forth. Go and look. If you look at this picture here, there's Marwa and Safa. How high are those mountains? They're 20 feet high. 20 feet is not make a mountain, folks. Those are nothing more than rocks. These are what we call facsimiles of mountains. That is not the original Marwa and Safa. Because if Hagar was living in Mecca, where Abraham was living, and he throws her out of Mecca so that she can go out in the desert, and she runs out of water, what is she only doing 100 yards away from the Kaaba? She could just go and knock on any door and get water. If you're only 100 yards away. Obviously, this has nothing to do with Hagar. It has everything to do with Jerusalem. Why? What is the name of Moriah in Arabic? Marwa. What's across the Kidron Valley on the other side? Mount Sopris. Safa. Marwa and Safa are nothing more than Moriah and Mount Socopis, which is on the other side of the Kidron Valley. It comes straight out of Jerusalem. It comes straight out of Judaism. Are you following me? You people should know this better than anybody else because you work with Jews. This is your background. You can say this better than I can. Then they go to that Safman Medrash. There you can see Mount Scopus, there is Moriah, that's where the Dome of the Rock is today, and there is Mount Scopus, right across the Kidron Valley. And what is the Kidron Valley? It's the valley where Gehenna is. Gehenna, which is hell, will open up. That's what Muslims think will happen exactly between Marwa and Safa. That's straight out of our apocalypse. It comes straight out of the scriptures. Now let's go to the hill of Arafat in Mecca. Now the hill of Arafat is actually found also in Petra. When we go then to the Jamaats, these are the Jamaats where they do and they throw the stones at the devil. Problem is, it always used to be one pillar. 49 stones or 72 stones. You've all seen pictures of that. Look and see what has happened today. They now have 3 pillars, 3 towers. It's actually 4 there because one's a rest place. They now have 4 towers, 3 towers there where they're throwing stones. And the reason why is because everybody was throwing stones on top of everybody else and killing people during the Hajj. So to protect them, they had to build 2 more towers. So they've got to change the narrative. So what is the narrative today? Since 1980, if you go to Mecca, when you go to the Jamarats, they say these are the 3 temptations of Abraham. If since 1980, in the last 40 years, they have changed the narrative, why are you surprised that the entire narrative has been changing for the last 1,400 years? It's even happening during your lifetime. And then they go to the Zamzam well. Now, when Muslims say, well, whenever you say there's no water in Mecca, they'll say, yes, there is, Mr. Smith, the Zamzam well. There's a picture of the Zamzam well. It's about 30 feet across and about 40 feet deep. If you go to any of the Muslim shops here in London, you will see Zamzam water. All over the Muslim world, there is Zamzam water. There are millions and millions of liters of Zamzam water. And when you drink it, you will be blessed. It's slightly perfumed. And according to all the Muslim clerics, this water never runs out. That's why they can supply the whole world with Zamzam well. Thank Alhamdulillah, thank be to Allah. Have you heard them say this? That's why they say the Zamzam well has been there forever. No, it has not. There is no reference to any Zamzam well before the Ottoman period. It has all been introduced by the Ottomans. The Germans are going to tell us all about it. What's most important is, where do you think they get all of this water that supplies all of your shops all over London and all over the Muslim world? Ask your Muslim where that water comes from. They say it comes from Allah. No, it doesn't. Take a look at a modern, go on Google it tonight. I won't have time to do it. Look at the pipes that go into the well and the pipes that come out of that well. The pipes that go into well come from Jeddah. They come from desalination plants made by Bechtel organization, by Bechtel company in America. It has nothing to do with Allah. It has everything to do with America. Thank you for giving us the credit that God supposedly deserves. They even put the perfume in it so that it can be seen as holy water. Then we get to the black stone. How many people know about the black stone? It's in the eastern corner of the Kaaba, the holiest place in history of mankind. And there's this black stone. As they're circumambulating seven times, they try to kiss that stone. And when they kiss that stone, their sins are forgiven. Does that not suggest idolatry to you? Yet is there only one God but God? How can someone else forgive your sins but God? What is that doing in the Kaaba? And where did that black stone come from? Ask your Muslim friends this. It actually comes from Elagabalus, Roman emperor, who created it and said that wherever the black stone is, so is God's presence. It was a Rome that actually introduced it, invented it. It was a meteor. It was a meteorite that has been broken up into eight pieces. That's a whole history we're not going to get in tonight. It just gets juicier and juicier. And now, so in conclusion, we're going to have a break then after this. I want to look at, we've now looked at, we can't find any place in the Quran that is Mecca. We could not find any reference to Mecca on any map. Gibson pretty much destroyed any reference to Mecca by the Qiblas. We now know that the trade route theory has been debunked. We've also debunked the whole theory that it came to Jeddah. It went on the African side, and we have pretty much shut down the Hajj. Folks, if you don't have Mecca, you don't have Islam, because you don't have Muhammad.